I had a news director a number of years back, and he might even be listening to this segment, Kingsley Smith. And now he works at the NFL Network, but he was from Texas. And he used to tell me, are you doing any commentary? And I said, well, every once in a while, we do the Kilcoin Opinion, TKO. And he said, you got to do that every night. I said, well, I don't want to do it every night. It's not easy to have something to say, some type of commentary every night. And he said, but if you do it every once in a while, nobody knows to look for it. And he started talking about the guy in Dallas, Dale Hansen, who had been doing it for years and had been known to just piss everybody off. But everybody watched. Everybody talked about him. So Kings and I would always joke about Dale Hansen this, Dale Hansen that. So that's about when we started doing TKO every night instead of just occasionally. And rarely does the TKO, you know, end up really upsetting somebody. Every once in a while, a couple of nasty emails here and there for the most part. And these are different styles. I mean, I think my personality is going to be more sarcastic, lighthearted, joking about stuff. Whereas Dale Hansen over the years had really, really ticked some people off. And I read a recent story in The Ringer, Brian Curtis, who writes about media topics. In fact, and I don't know the man at all, but he called me in 2016. He was writing a piece, television related, about how the St. Louis TV guys would cover the Rams now that they were in LA. And I said, well, I'm sure we'll show some highlights. Probably all the bad ones, the fumbles, the interceptions, anything they did that was terrible was what we'll show. And I said, you know, I guess you could play it straight. And he said, well, why not? Why not just show the highlights and give the score? And I said, because that's not what I do. It's not my style. And I said, nobody wants that. So that first time I ever heard Brian Curtis's name, but he wrote an interesting story about Dale Hansen, who's about to retire. The man's 73. He's been in Dallas for 40 years or so and has been an institution. Whether they love him or hate him, everybody knows him. Did the radio for the Cowboys, fired by Jerry Jones, although he said he quit before he got fired. Drinking buddies with Jerry, but has probably said more nasty things about Jerry than anybody. I've always been sort of fascinated how that career unfolded, how it began. Then he was real outspoken, defending Michael Sam as an openly gay NFL player, saying he deserves a shot. Ended up on the Ellen Show, and you know, a guy in his mid to late 60s at the time went viral, whatever that is. And I guess it's surprising to me the level of success, because you think of Texas and you think conservative. And in the interview, he says, you know what I am? He said, I'm a leftover hippie from the 60s, which I never would have thought of either. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about the career, some of the great stories where he was sitting at a bar and his newscast was going to be on late, and he looked up and the news had started and he was still sitting at the bar and he had to, you know, bust his tail to get back in time for sports. Interesting conversation. Interesting guy. Don't know him from Adam. Made a couple of inquiries, some people I know in Dallas, and then we started talking. And I thought it'd be fun to hear some of these stories retold from over the years. He's retiring, I think, in mid-September. So Dale Hansen, the subject of the latest Kilcoin Conversation. It's presented, as always, by Marie Davila Senior Living, located at the corner of Clayton and Weidman Road, Premier Senior Living. Check out those villa estates. Whatever you're looking for, assisted living, they have all different levels of care. MarieDavila.com. You can take a virtual tour since 1960. That is the premier spot. Really is a beautiful campus, 60 acres out there in West County. Also, Triad Bank, which is the St. Louis-based bank, started here in 2005, five-star rated bank for all of those banking needs, including just your normal personal banking. You want to go into the lobby, talk to folks. They're real friendly. If you're a business owner, talk to Jim Regna. He's the CEO. They can help you do more business. TriadBanking.com, the website, or in person. It's on Clayton Road in Frontenac. Appliance Discounters, where everyone right now that's building or updating, upgrading, wants some new appliances, and you get told, hey, it's going to be a couple of months. It's ridiculous. Call the folks at Appliance Discounters and get those delivered within days. That's the beauty of having an 80,000 square foot warehouse in downtown St. Louis. It means you can get your items quickly delivered. Great GE products, General Electric, GE rebates, all of it online at theappliancediscounters.com. Start the search there. Washer, dryer, stove, refrigerator, you name it, General Electric, the best in the business, lowest prices. That's what Appliance Discounters is all about. Stop by any of their area showrooms or go online, theappliancediscounters.com. Their savings are your savings. And B&G Tuckpointing, the best in the bricks. So many brick homes in the greater St. Louis area. And if things are starting to look a little shabby, it's possible the tuckpointing needs to be updated. You can make that home look new again with the best in the bricks. BGTuckPointing.com. Chimney, garage, entire home, waterproofing, foundation repair. They do all of that. 363-0525. 314-363-0525. Make sure you talk to Rich Galati. He's the owner. The B and the G, that's his daughters, Bella and Gabrielle. It's a family operation. BGTuckPointing.com. And now, our conversation with Dale Hansen.
It's funny because as we got started here, you were talking about how you've been fired before. I was thinking about this for someone as, you know, candid or controversial as you. Are you surprised that your career ends on your terms?
Oh, I'm shocked. I mean, I actually never thought I would make it, quite honestly. When I started at Channel 8, WFAA, they gave me a 13-week contract. And there were several days in that 13 weeks. I didn't think I'd make it through the 13 weeks. To think that I have somehow made it 38 years at Channel 8 and getting to decide when I want to leave and how I want to leave. Yeah, that's pretty surprising to me.
Can Dale Hansen go to the grocery store in Dallas without somebody come up and say, I love you, I hate you? I mean, how vocal are people in public?
You know, I usually get a little bit of both of that. The thing I've always said, I used to hang out with Troy Aikman quite a bit, you know, the great Cowboys quarterback. And when you're with Aikman, it's like traveling with a rock star. You know, you couldn't take three. We were in Omaha, Nebraska, and he's getting mobbed by people in Omaha, Nebraska back in the 90s. I mean, it was amazing. What I've always told him and what I tell everybody is I think I've always had just the right amount of that kind of stuff. I still like it, you know, but I'll be sitting up at my favorite little cigar bar, a place called Javier's, and people come up to the table all the time. And I've had both. I've had both almost every place I go. Hey, man, I just want to tell you, I really enjoy your stuff. I really like your opinions. I really like the fact that, you know, you give Jerry Jones grief all the time. And then I've had people walk up and say, I'll never forget what you did to SMU. I'll never forgive you for this saying that or whatever. But just the right amount, just the right amount, just enough to kind of feel good about what I do, but not enough to be a major inconvenience in my life. Well, like a lot of the true celebrities have to deal with on a regular basis.
Have the TV consultants ever tried to change you, or do they ever say, why don't you do that? And you tell them to stuff it? Or, I mean, I'm wondering if they left you alone.
No, I've actually, I think it was one of the best things I've done. And I tell a lot of young people this. Most people in our business hate consultants. I've always kind of gravitated toward them. I think maybe in part because I didn't know anything about television when I started. I mean, nothing about television when I started. I didn't go to college. And so when I first started in radio, I went to we had all these seminars. Almost every month there was a seminar like at Drake University, Iowa State University. Even when I was in St. Cloud, Minnesota, I went down to Chicago for a symposium that, you know, you paid back $25 and you'd hear different speakers and the like. And the first consultant I ever dealt with was in Omaha, Nebraska, and she helped me quite a bit, quite frankly. But I'll never forget, I walked in there, everybody else was complaining like, hey, I've been doing this 4 years. I knew everything there is to know. My attitude has always been, maybe there's something I can learn from this person. Never planning. And I've always told them, listen, I'm not going to buy into a lot of what you're selling here. I'm just not. But maybe you could teach me something, and I'm willing to look for that. I'm willing to listen for that. I had a woman, strange as it might sound, but I had a woman tell me to pause my delivery. You know, typical sportscasters, I was always taught you talk real fast. You know, you that conveys enthusiasm. And I'll never forget, this was in Omaha, Nebraska, and this woman sits me down. We're going through all this different stuff. She goes, you know, you're really kind of clever. You're actually pretty funny sometimes. And you do say some things that a lot of people don't say. But you talk so fast, I can't keep up. And I really did. And she goes, I think if you could just kind of find a way to let those thoughts sink in, to let that punchline resonate, I think it would help. And when I came to Dallas, people thought, oh, I was trying to imitate Paul Harvey. I don't know if you remember him or not, but I mean, just an unbelievable old radio voice and a great delivery and everything. And people did. They called me, you know, like Paul Harvey Light, because I was really struggling to find that that style, if you will. And I think, you know, I've kind of developed what people call my staccato delivery and the like. And the bottom line is it helps. I never tell anybody I'm not interested, because I think I'm smart enough that I can still try to learn from time to time.
It seems you've given Jerry Jones more grief than most, right? And yet are you guys friends? And how did you end up in the radio booth? Because you're not a former Cowboy. How did you get that job?
Well, I got that job because former Cowboys president Tex Schramm loved having the main TV guy on the broadcast. And I think, now again, the greatness of Vern Lundquist was unquestioned. But he always had a TV guy doing the broadcast. I mean, Frank Kleber did it for a while and others. But I think he always looked at Vern Lundquist with a kind of a double point of view. One, he really was good, of course. But then he also had the benefit that Vern Lundquist is the number one guy on TV. And it kind of gave a little validation to the Cowboys. I mean, obviously, you're going to cover the Cowboys in this market, but I think in my case, he thought it probably would buy him a little coverage along the way. Because every time I would say something negative about the Cowboys, which wasn't much in the 80s, but on the rare occasions that I did, he would call me like, you don't understand. You work for the Cowboys. I'm like, no, I don't. I mean, no, I don't. But that's how it started. When Vern went to the network full time, Tex Schramm called me. And I think without question, the only reason he called me was because I was the TV guy in town. So he auditioned me, actually. That first year Vern left, they had like four or five different people doing a couple of games. And it clicked. I mean, Brad Sham and I clicked. And so then they gave me the job full time. Then Jones came along. Yeah, it's been an interesting ride with Jerry Jones. I think there was a day when we might have been considered friends. That day's long gone. But Jones is a unique individual, and I really do respect this. No matter how hard you hit him, no matter how much you say about him in a negative way, he'll come back for more. He pops right back up. I mean, I think he loves being on camera. He loves being the center of attention. But, you know, I don't know about you, but I've had a lot of people over the years say, no, I'm not doing an interview with you. You know, you're too critical. You're a smart aleck. No, I'm not talking to you. And I'm like, well, that's kind of your job. I'm doing my job. You need to do yours. And Jones always comes back for more. And I love that. But I think this might sum it up perfectly for you. They had a big media party at Cowboys training camp this year. I made my last trip out there. And we're at this beautiful restaurant in Malibu, just an absolutely gorgeous place. And Jones stops the party, calls everybody around us. And there's 150, 200 people, whatever it was. And presents me with this beautifully silver wrap big bow box. And I open up the box and it's dirty socks and jocks. And that's what he gave me for a going away gift after 40 years. A box of, that was his great line when he came in 1999. I'm going to be in charge of socks and jocks. And I made fun of him for it. And he said, well, you always remember that great line. You know, you thought it was perfect. So here you go. And he gave me a box of dirty socks and jocks. And some of my friends were almost offended by it, that he should have given me something else. No, hell, he's Jerry Jones. That's actually kind of funny to me.
Did he fire you from the radio, or you quit? It's unclear. Or no, you definitely quit before he fired you?
As I said to him back then, well, you can't really fire me because I quit. And as he said on my last interview on the interview from Cowboys training camp, he and the radio station that I was working for, KBIL, a guy named Ron Chapman. And Ron Chapman called Jerry and he said, nobody quits on us. We have to fire them. We don't allow people to quit. So they fired me after I quit. The next day, Ron Chapman goes on his radio show and he just blows me up. He said, Dale Hansen's the worst human being in the world. You can't possibly work with Dale Hansen. Nobody likes Dale Hansen. We have to get rid of him. So I then called the station and told the general manager, a guy named Bob Cooper, never forget it. I said, Bob, I want my check for the remaining season. Because there were like five games to go in the season when they, quote, fired me. And I said, I want my checks for the remaining games. And he goes, well, Dale, I don't think we owe you that. I mean, you quit. I said, well, I thought I quit, Bob. But I heard on the radio this morning that you fired me because I'm a bad guy. So I want my money. And he goes, well, I don't think we owe you that. And I said, well, quite honestly, I don't either, but my lawyers do. So would you like me to have them call you? They sent me a check for several thousand dollars for games I did not do. So in that regard, I'm more than happy to say they fired me. But I finally got Jones to admit that I quit the day before he announced that I was fired. So I thought it was kind of funny.
Were you drinking, buddies? I mean, the piece in The Ringer by Brian Curtis, there's some classic stories, including what, in Austin, Texas, maybe that's a late night club, and they don't want to serve Jerry. Tell us that story. They don't want to serve Jerry, but he's going to do something about it.
Yeah, oh, it was classic. I mean, this was in the early days. It was another media party. The Cowboys have always thrown big media parties at the training camp because they're one of the most, how would you describe that? I mean, they love to manipulate the media any way they think they can. There's no question about that. But they've always done it. I mean, Tex Schramm did it before Jerry. Jerry has taken it to another level. But it was the first year. It was 1990. The Cowboys had moved to Austin for training camp. And at that time, Jones and I had a pretty good relationship. And Jones actually would be out during the week, for example, in Austin. And, you know, he'd come into the same bars that all of us were hanging out at. And he'd end up buying drinks for everybody and all that kind of nonsense. So it was rather typical. And he's having a media party. So I'd already left. It was the final week of training camp. And I'd already come back home. Jerry actually calls me at home. I said, Dale, I just found out you left. I didn't realize you were gone. I can't have a media party if you're not here. So I flew back to Austin and went to the media party. Well, it was a hell of a party. It was a hell of a party. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, the party's winding down. We're leaving this one club that's closing, of course, at 2 o'clock. Jones says, I know a place on 6th Street in Austin, which they do. They stay open all night, but they don't serve alcohol. He goes, let's go down there and let's listen to some music for a while and let's hang out. I went, all right, okay. So there's about a half a dozen of us. And we follow Jones to this bar. We walk in. Jones says, we're going to need drinks for everybody. The bartender looks at Jerry and says, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, but it's 2 o'clock and we can't sell alcohol after 2 o'clock. And Jones looks at the guy, I'll never forget this, looks at the guy and says, buddy, either you start serving drinks or I buy this bar tomorrow and you're the first son of a bitch I fire. Next thing I know, Jones tells me to go in the bathroom. I said, I don't have to go to the bathroom. He said, go to the bathroom. I walk in the bathroom. There's a guy sitting on a stool. And he's got the complete bar set up. And we sat there and drank till about probably 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. I leave, I get a cab to get me back to the hotel. I sleep till about 4 o'clock the next afternoon. I'm rushing over to the practice facility. And I can tell these stories now because I'm retiring yet. But I rush over to the practice facility to do my 6 o'clock sportscast. Jones had done Good Morning America at 7 o'clock that morning, held a press conference at noon, and was at the morning and afternoon practices. I mean, I don't know how he did it. And I come staggering up there, and I've been a little bit overserved, and I'm not feeling real well. And Joe's looking, big man, come on, let me tell you what happened. I said, no, I don't want to hear anything else. I'm done. I don't want to hear anything else. And I left him in a bar sometime between 4:30 and 5. And he's on Good Morning America at 7 o'clock and was at both practices and did a press conference at noon. And at about 4:30, when I get to the practice facility, he's still going 190 miles an hour. You talk about a guy that can burn the candle at both ends. My goodness, he was something else. He was absolutely something else.
So I think people hear the stories like, boy, Dale, he's old school. You know, you get a cigar, you get some scotch.
Yep.
Old school. But then you say he's going to do commentaries about Michael Sam and having gay players in the NFL and maybe call out the governor for some of his, you know, loosening, opening up the state, like what might be considered more, some of your views might be more progressive. How many people are surprised? Like, that's coming out of Dale's mouth. I mean, I think they might say this guy's into bull riding and guns, and yet a lot of your commentaries are more socially liberal. And has it always been that way? And are people probably see you and stereotype you as the good old boy, and actually not from Texas, right? From Iowa. But surprised should people be about your views?
Well, I don't think they are now, obviously, but they were absolutely, certainly nationally. The Michael Sam commentary was obviously the commentary that put me on the national map. Went live, viral, whatever you call that. You know, Reddit picks it up. Somebody made one of those songs about it where I'm singing the commentary and everything. Most people in Texas, although I hadn't done, quite frankly, a lot of, you know, what you would perceive as social commentaries. But I was perceived without question, even locally, you know, as that old school guy that likes a drink, likes a cigar, loves his football, probably lives in a big house, you know, makes good money, whatever. And never had a real clue as to where my politics are, where my social attitudes are. And then when Michael Sam came along, I mean, that pulled the curtain completely back. And I received more than 6,000 emails. I'm not talking about even Facebook postings and Twitters and whatever you call that stuff, Instagram, or like, I'm talking about emails that were actually addressed and sent to me. And I stopped counting at 6,000. And every state in the union, 27 countries sent me an email. It was amazing. And almost every single one of them from outside Dallas, although there were even some from the Dallas area, but every one of them from outside Dallas began with, I can't believe that an old fat white guy in Dallas, Texas would say these kind of things about Michael Sam. I was prepared to smash my computer screen only to find out da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I personally have always been that way. And I've said a few things that I think people should have realized along the way. I did a commentary years ago in the 80s about former football coach Jackie Sherrill. And he made this incredibly racist comment to me on a phone call after insisting that everything was off the record. I mean, on the record. Everything's on the record. And I'm recording the conversation. And he makes this incredibly ignorant comment about his black quarterback because we had exposed the fact that his quarterback was getting all these illegal benefits. He got a car and everything. And when we confronted Kevin Murray about that, Kevin Murray says he didn't recognize his signature and he doesn't remember what kind of a car he drives. That was their explanation after the fact. When we showed him the lease, he didn't recognize it. So I said, how is it possible? How is it possible that your quarterback, who knows everything about every player on the team, doesn't recognize his signature and forgot what kind of a car he drives? And Jackie Sherrill said to me, well, you know how these colored boys are. You can make them football smart, but you can never make them smart. They live in a jungle and you do the best you can. And I'm like, wow, okay, thanks. He goes, what do you mean thanks? I said, oh, that's going to be a big story. And he goes, well, you can't use that. And I said, well, you already said everything's on the record. Well, about that. And I said, I'm sorry, but it's a little bit too late. So anyway, I did a commentary surrounding that. And at the end of the commentary, I said, I'm one of those crazy liberals from the 60s who believes what Bobby Kennedy always used to say. Some men see things that they are and ask why. I see things that they could be and ask why not. And I got a little bit of grief about it. But the fact that Jackie Sherrill had made that outrageous comment and everything else, I think it kind of got lost in the ether about the liberal part. Now, my boss was actually very mad. In that commentary, I called Jackie Sherrill a disgusting human being. And one of our co-anchors, John McKay at the time, says, oh, man, you're going to get in trouble for that. You cannot call the football coach at Texas A&M a disgusting human being. You're going to get in a lot of trouble. The next day, the great Dave Lane, the greatest general manager in the history of television, calls me into his office and throws the commentary at me, actually wads it up and fires it at me, and said, did you save this on our air? And I said, well, yeah, I did. And he goes, what were you thinking? And I said, well, I think Jackie Sherrill's a disgusting human being, and I wanted to say so. He goes, no, you proved that. I'm fine with that. You actually quoted that damn Bobby Kennedy and told people that you're a liberal? And I said, so that's your problem? He goes, you can't tell people you're a liberal and quote that damn Bobby Kennedy on our air. And that was it. But I think, again, a few other commentaries along the way would have made it pretty clear where my leanings are, if you will. But then when Michael Sam came along, that pulled the curtain all the way back. And then it's been, since that time, it's been a constant, hey, man, I love you, Dale. You're the greatest guy in the world. Thank you for taking such a courageous stand. Or you crazy hippie, communist, socialist, Marxist pig, get off the air. Nobody cares. Just give us the ball scores and shut up. And yeah, okay. You know, it's somewhere in between there.
Did you ever just give the ball scores? I can't see that. But I can't see you in the 80s being the wacky video guy either, who had, you know, the squirrel on a water ski. I can't see you doing that either.
Well, I was probably closer to the wacky squirrel guy than I was, you know, just ball scores and highlights. No, I've never done just ball scores and highlights. I mean, when I first started, I did, obviously. I mean, in the 70s, my first TV job was KMTV in Omaha, Nebraska. But even then, I was doing the Tom Osborne show, and I worked with this guy, just a brilliant photographer, editor, producer. He taught me everything I know, a guy named Danny Livingston. He taught me everything I know. And he had kind of a crazy part to his mind as well. So we were doing the Tom Osborne show, the football coaches show, if you will. And there's never been a better one. I've never seen a better coaches show than what Danny Livingston created, that he and I did with Tom Osborne. Because we had cheerleader bits. We had band members. We did segments with people in the stands, tailgating parties outside the stadium. So you sat down, you got the highlights, you got the coach talking about, well, Jarvis Redwine made a good cut here, and that's where he was able to make the touchdown run. And yeah, we had all of that nonsense. But you sat down for an hour, you came away with the entire experience. And quite honestly, I kind of kept raising that bar. Well, let's try this. Butch Johnson, back in the early 80s, when the craze was all these touchdown celebrations, and Butch Johnson was a Cowboys receiver, we created together the California Quake, he called it, and he'd score a touchdown and shake and everything. And we did that in my living room at about 2:30 in the morning in the condo that I was living in. So the next day I went out on the streets and we did this bit where when Butch Johnson does the California Quake, what do you think it should look like? And it was just crazy as you could possibly imagine. And I did stuff like that. I did one of my first stories when I came to Channel 8, which was a little scary, I was really crazy at Channel 4. I mean, I did a lot of weird stuff at Channel 4. But I toned it down at Channel 8 only because I had guys like Jerry Orr who did crazy stuff. I had more reporters, more storytellers that I didn't have at Channel 4. So I toned it down a bit. But the first story I ever did at Channel 8 was Tom Landry is actually Superman. And I did this story from Cowboys training camp, how Tom Landry showed up in 1960, coincidentally, the very year that Superman left the networks. And Perry White, Superman's old boss, Perry White, former newspaper man, Tex Schramm, a former newspaper man, doing his whole bit. And we had Landry on a bicycle pedaling like he always did. And I walked up behind him with a green rock. We painted a rock green, slowed down the video. I pulled the rock back. We speed. I mean, all that nonsense. And I remember David Zurawick wrote a piece about me moving to Channel 8. And then after we did that, that was on our first sports special that we ever did on a Sunday night. And I'll never forget, David Zurawick wrote the line, sports special will become one of the most dominant sports shows in Dallas-Fort Worth if they could just keep Dale Hansen out of the way. And then I thought, well, they didn't, but it still is. And so it worked out. But no, I've always wanted to – people say to me all the time, are you an entertainer or are you a journalist? And my answer is always the same, and it's yes. Yes, I am. I try to entertain. I try to make you laugh. I try to make you think. And, oh, by the way, I do ball scores and tell stories. And I think I wear both hats, and I don't apologize for that, and I never have.
So as a TV sports guy, I have the recurring dream where I'm missing slot or I can't find my scripts or I'm late to the set and just this weird sort of dream, this panic. And yet you famously lived it, right? You're watching TV. And
no, wait, back up a second. Are you saying you have that dream or you know that I have that dream?
No, I have this dream where not every night, but every once in a while, the dreams that I have include missing slot or not being able to get to the set, or I get out there and I can't find my microphone and they're all staring at me like constantly.
I swear to you, I have exactly the same dream. I swear to you, I thought you were. I thought somebody maybe you read that about me someplace.
No,
I have that dream where I'm. My main dream centers around the fact I'm rushing through downtown Dallas and people are hollering at me. You got to hurry. And I'm like, I'll make it. And I'm running into the studio, and then I usually wake up. And I can't find the microphone. I can't. Oh, wow. That's the craziest thing ever. That's the craziest thing.
It's maybe a couple times a week, a couple times a month. I don't know. But it'll wake up and I'll say, oh, my God, I thought I was getting fired. I couldn't find my scripts, or I forgot to put in a rundown.
Oh, my gosh. I swear to you. I swear to you, exactly the same dream.
Maybe it's more widespread than we realize. But for you, you should have it because it actually – Well, you were watched famously, and again, Brian Curtis, who does a great job at The Ringer, nice profile on you, but tells that story where you looked up, you're at the bar, and you look up, and you go, holy bleep, the news has started. Tell us that story.
Well, yeah, I don't know about you, but I think the reason I have the dream is because I've also lived it in real life. That story you're talking about was... and it's somewhat legendary, fortunately or unfortunately. But it was the night, in my defense, and this isn't much of a defense, by the way, but in my defense, it was the night of the Republican nominating convention for George Bush. In, what is that, late 87, I guess it actually would be, right? And then when they, what are the, 88, whatever it is, whatever the election year was. I wasn't a voter back then, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. But anyway, it's the Republican nominating convention for George Bush. And I'm sitting at the bar with a bunch of my buddies because I know we're going to be on incredibly late that night. I mean, instead of being on at 10:30, we were going to be on like at 11:30, quarter to 12. They got to go through every state in the union and they make their big speeches and then they cheer and dance and party. So I'm sitting here and I look up and I said, where are they at? And they said, Alabama. I said, oh, great. We got the whole alphabet to go yet. And I look up and I said, where are they? And they said, Nebraska. I said, oh, not a problem. We're only halfway there. I keep drinking my beers. I said, where are they at? They said, Texas. I said, oh, not a problem. We got Wisconsin, Wyoming, Washington, you know. I said, I got 30, 40 minutes yet. A couple of minutes later, luckily, I just turn around and I look up. We're on the air. And I know we're on the air because we got both anchors sitting there. And we never do a cut-in with one, you know, with both anchors. We're a tease. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're on the air. And I don't know how long we've been on the air. And I'm quite a ways away from the station. I run outside the bar. My car's being blocked in. I run back inside the bar. I jump up on top of the bar. There's a guy driving like a burgundy Jaguar has got me blocked in. I scream, you have 5 seconds to move that car. I drive through it. Some guy flies up. Not necessarily proud of this, you understand, but I somehow turned like a 15-minute 20-minute drive into like 6.5 minutes. And I literally come sliding in the parking lot to the back door, and Jose Gant, my producer, is standing there holding my scripts in one hand and my jacket in the other. And I run into the set. They are in the middle of the commercial break going to sports. I had missed a tease, if you will, but that's not a big deal. But we are actually in the middle of the commercial break. And Jose is stuttering like crazy. He gets all excited. He can't talk. I said, just shut up. Come here. And in those days, we did a lot of baseball games, right? It's in the summer. It's in the 80s. So I'm probably showing highlights of 5 or 6 baseball games. That's basically the sportscast back then. He's kneeling out of sight, out of camera range. And all I had on my script was Rangers open a 3-game series against Oakland. And I reach down and he hands me the notes. I go, Pete O'Brien doubles here in the first inning to drive in 2 runs, put the Rangers out front. Then I grab another note. I go, but, you know, Oakland's, Jose Canseco homers in the bottom of the 7th to drive in 3, the Rangers. And we did that all the way through the sportscast. I don't have any scripts. I haven't seen any of the highlights. I don't know what the highlights are. And we nail it. we nail it. And like I told Brian Curtis, I mean, the idiot that I am, I then went back to the bar because I had to kind of celebrate the moment. And I get a standing ovation when I walk in the bar. And, we survived it. We survived it. And they wrote about it in a newspaper, in a magazine article shortly after that. And again, that great Dave Lane that I'm referring to, he throws the magazine at me. He's so shocked and mad. Because it says in the article that I drank 13 beers. Now, this is over like a 4.5-hour period. It says I drank 13 beers in the article. And Dave Lane fires it at me. He said, is this article true? Is this true? I said, no, sir, it's not. It's just not. And he goes, what part of that's not true? And I said, well, it said I drank 13 beers, but Louis actually charged me for 16. So either Louis padded the tab, or I overpaid. It's one or the other. And he was so shocked. I mean, it was kind of a joke, but he was so shocked. And he goes, what were you thinking? I said, well, the bottom line is I wasn't, for starters. And I said, but Dave, I said, I think if you look at the tape again, that was a heck of a sportscast that night. I mean, I did a perfect sportscast. He goes, no, you look at the tape and I think you'll realize you said the Mets were in the American League. And without missing a beat, I looked at Dave Lane. I said, Dave, the Mets should be in the American League. There's just no reason they're not. And he goes, get out of my office. Get out of my office. I said, okay. That was a little bit of the 80s. Today, I think they'd have fired me before I got in the office. You know, they'd have sent me a note and just called it a day. But
Somebody would have posted a picture of you on Twitter, yeah, pounding beers in between newscasts.
Yeah. I probably would have been fired before the 10th newscast because it had been on Twitter and I'm pounding my beers and I don't know how many I drank. I drank quite a few, but it was over 4.5 hours.
And you're a big man.
Yeah. I had a certain amount of tolerance back in those days. As I've said to a lot of my friends, if Twitter was around in the 80s, I probably wouldn't have survived. I probably wouldn't have survived. And that's why I stay off it now. I mean, it's kind of a gotcha medium. And then so many people, I don't know about you, but so many people in our business, they insist upon putting their opinions out there at the most inopportune times. And what I said one time is, you know, I've never been on Twitter because I've never thought I had anything that needed to be said or was worth saying in 140 characters or less. Now it's what, 280, somebody told me, whatever. But I mean, I will give you my opinions. I will say something that will maybe shock you a little bit, but I will do it in a context that at least you have some ability to make sense of the argument, to have some understanding of the context of the joke or whatever. Now I go too far sometimes. I still miss. But if I was actively on Twitter, I think I'd be that guy that got fired. Because, I mean, I do have these flashes of what, boom, and I'd fire that off, you know. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. I don't apologize for my opinions. I don't apologize for being an opinionated guy. But I hate Twitter. I hate Twitter because I think the combination of I've seen so many people lose their jobs because they just feel compelled to say something outrageous in a small, limited format, or the other aspects of social media that, you know, a guy's in a bar having a beer and a smoke with his buddies, and oh, that becomes a big national thing. And I really do. I think social media is going to destroy our civilization as we know it. I know that's an old man talking, but you know, I always tell people, you know, we used to have people showing us their vacation pictures too, but my dad would close the drapes and lock the door and ignore the doorbell. We don't want to see your vacation pictures. We don't care what you had for dinner last night. We're not even really excited about seeing your baby pictures. I mean, you know, show us a couple and then move on. No. Let's show them 1,000 of them, you know. And I don't know. It just, for whatever reason, it just rubs me the wrong way most of the time. So I don't get involved in that nonsense.
Final thought. Will you cry on the final show as you say goodbye? How weird will it be getting in that car knowing that's it?
It's going to be weird. In all seriousness, I don't think I'll cry. Let me just drop a huge name on you here for a moment. When I got this award in D.C., and I met Mr. Obama, former President Obama, in his office that day, and he gave me, he was joking me, he said, no crying tonight, no bawling up on that stage. Now, a little choke in the throat is a good thing. A little choke in the throat, that's a nice touch. But no balling up there, no balling. And basically, I've got this little farewell speech, if you will, that I've written. And I'd be a little disappointed almost if it doesn't maybe cause me to get a little catch in my throat on occasion. I think it's going to be a little weird. I think it's going to be a little weird knowing that it's over after... It's not just 38 years to me, it's 50. Since I spun my first, as I say in my farewell deal, since I spun my first record as a disc jockey in Newton, Iowa, it's been 50 years I've been doing this. And it's going to be rather shocking to realize this is it. I hope like hell I don't start crying. I don't think I will. But I also hope that I do have a legitimate occasional catch in my throat. Because I leave you with this. My mom died, and I do this segment every year called Thank God for Kids. And it's an old song by the Oak Ridge Boys. We put video to it in 1982, and I run it every year. It's become a very, very popular Christmas time segment that I do. And then I do a commentary of some kind, usually talking about a kid who had died the previous year or some kid battling cancer or whatever. But it's kind of a tear-jerking segment. And as people say, they like to get their cry in at Christmas time. So several years ago, my mom died. And so I knew I was going to write about my mom. and I had a lot of trouble writing it. And then I finally did. But I was so concerned that I would lose it during the because she had just died like 6 weeks earlier. I was so concerned that I would lose it during the broadcast. I had that thing almost memorized. I mean, I read it so many times so that when I did actually read it on the air, I was on remote control. I mean, you could have put a pistol to my head and said, what was the previous line you just said? And I couldn't have told you because I'm on remote control. And it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And some of my fellow workers even noticed it. It was like, were you happy with it? I said, no, I hated it. And one of our anchors, Shelley Slater, said, yeah, I didn't think you would like it. There was no emotion at all. And I usually tend to wear my emotions on my sleeve. And I said, but it almost had to be that way, because if I stopped to think about my mom, who had just died 6 weeks earlier, I think I would have lost it and broken down crying. And I didn't want to do that either, obviously. And I think there's something similar to that for this time. For me to convey the message that I hope to convey when I leave, there has to be some emotion attached to it. There just has to be, for people to have a true understanding of how much I appreciate the opportunity that I've been given, the support that I've been given, the platform that I've been given. I think there has to be a bit of a choke in my throat to convey that. If I get the sobbing up there, then I'll probably just wrap it up and call it a day. But I don't think I will. I'm not necessarily looking forward to doing my last broadcast ever, but I am kind of looking forward to reading this final commentary on the air, because I'm kind of proud of it. I talk about a lot of different things. It seems too long to me, quite frankly. It runs like 3 minutes and 20 seconds, and it's got video in it and that kind of stuff. But I've read it to a few people, and every one of them, like, that's the fastest 320 I've ever heard in my life, because it's pretty good, I hope. I mean, I kind of like it. I kind of like it. So I'll take my chances and see how it's received.
Well, hopefully you made it this far. It's one of our longer visits, and I just enjoy hearing people tell stories. And if they're a little longer stories, I'm fine with it. And if people have been in the business for a long time, I'm interested. And Dick Ford was a longtime newsman in St. Louis. He had been retired for a number of years, and he worked into his early 70s. And I started having him on my radio show on KTRS, and people loved it. They'd be texting in, ask him about this, or can we call in? People loved it. And after we did it a couple times, I wanted to have him back, and he said, Martin, nobody cares about an old newsman. They don't want to hear his stories. And I said, actually, Dick, that's not true. People do want to hear your old stories. So I guess it's not just me. So I enjoyed getting to talk to Dale Hansen again. I'd heard that name for many years. Namely, the old news director, Kingsley Smith, had told stories. And fun to hear just the kind of crazy time. It was a different era for sportscasters, you know. A lot of drinking in between shows. I mean, believe it or not, that doesn't go on anymore. So appreciate him being on the show. As always, all of the segments are posted at ScoopsWithDannyMac.com. Available on Spotify and iTunes. It's the Kilcoin Conversation. Make sure you take care of our sponsors. Let them know you've heard their name on this show, whether it's Marie Davila, Senior Living, maybe it's mom or dad, maybe it's an aunt, maybe it's an uncle, and they're looking for a place to live in retirement. MarieDavila.com. Take that virtual tour. And business owners, Triad Bank, these really are great folks based in St. Louis. So when you're deciding what you want to do next, and they say, let's talk about it, instead of getting on the phone and saying we're going to call LA or New York, they make the decision right here in St. Louis. TriadBanking.com, or just go to that lobby in Frontenac on Clayton Road, about a block west of Lindbergh, real close to Highway 40 in Lindbergh. Easy to get to. Stop by, ask for Jim Regnan. Tell him, Martin's been talking about you for so long, I'd like to do a little bit of business. Please let him know that you heard about it on the Kilcoin Conversation. BG Tuck Pointing, it really is simple. If you've got a brick home, update it with the tuck pointing. Maybe the chimney's falling apart. Call B&G at 363 314-363-0525. 314-363-0525 or on the web. It's bgtuckpointing.com. And appliance discounters, just connected some folks I know who are building homes for our older residents who are a little lower income, and they're building some homes for them, and they outfit the apartments, should say apartments, not homes, but they outfit every apartment with new appliances. And I said, hey, light bulb went off. I said, you got to talk to the folks at Appliance Discounters. Put those two in contact, because Appliance Discounters has huge inventory at low prices. It's what they do. All the big names, all the great brand names, including GE, General Electric, find them at theappliancediscounters.com. They're all around the area with great showrooms. Stop by and see them in person. I'm Martin Kilcoyne. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again soon.